Scores of books have been published about Benjamin Franklin, the American author, scientist, inventor, diplomat, and founding father, but until now, little has been written about the person he regarded as his soulmate, his younger sister Jane. Although Ben was 6 years older than Jane, they had a special bond. He taught her to read and ended up writing more letters to her than to anyone else over the course of his lifetime. Jill Lepore, a staff writer at The New Yorker and a professor of American history at Harvard, gave us a portrait of the long-overlooked Jane in her latest book, Book of Ages. She was here in October to talk about it. We're re-airing that conversation for you on this Christmas Eve. I began by noting that Jill Lepore had said it was her mother who had encouraged her to write about Jane Franklin, and I asked, what had sparked your mother's interest in Jane?
My mother encouraged me to do anything she thought I actually wanted to do. That's what mothers do, right? They sort of reflect back at you, your inner self. So I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, and I happened to grow up on Franklin Street, like one of the many streets that was laid out on one of the many anniversaries of Franklin's birth. And, you know, Benjamin Franklin's a story of I learned in school as a school kid. And at some point when I was in graduate school, I came across Franklin's papers in the library and sat and read them all, you know, the sort of 40 or so volumes of Franklin's papers, and just discovered that, you know, it seemed like every other letter he wrote was to this sister of his named Jane, and I'd never heard of her before. And I remember telling my mother about this, you know, sort of kitchen table conversation, and she said, you have to write a book about her. We need to know about Jane Franklin. And I thought, you know, that's nuts, because the problem with writing about Jane Franklin is that Franklin sent many letters to Jane, almost all of which she kept and really treasured. But the many letters that she sent to him, about half of them have been lost.
And we don't even have a painting of her, do we?
No.
Do we know what she looked like?
No. People ask me that all the time. I don't feel like I really particularly need to know what she looked like. But, you know, it's not going to take a fortune to get your portrait painted in the 18th century, but it's pricey.
Your mother died before your book was published, but you've said that you were able to share some of the work in progress with her. Were you able to answer the questions that she'd had about Jane in her life? Because you wrote about that in a New Yorker article.
Yeah. I mainly tell my mother stories about Jane. My mother had been really confined to the house for a long time, taking care of my father. And, you know, when your world is a little bit confined by circumstance, how hungry you are for stories of a bigger world. And just my job as her daughter was come visit or call and tell the most outrageous stories that I could come up with, however harebrained and however wildly embroidered. But she loved the stories about Jane because she loved the idea that there was, you know, Benjamin Franklin really works in American culture as an allegory, right? Like, people don't know that much about Franklin himself, but we think about him as in this allegorical figure, the self-made man, rags to riches. Like, literally, people brought rags to his shop. He bought them to make paper, and with that paper, he printed money. Like, rags to riches, it really is Franklin's story. But Jane Franklin's life, you know, she had 12 kids. She, her life was rags to rags. So I think my mother really was drawn to that, the power of that allegory.
Beyond the letters, how difficult was it for you to find information about her?
It was really, really hard. You know, actually, Carl Van Doren, the great Franklin biographer, who also wrote a tremendous biography of Swift years and years ago, was obsessed with Jane Franklin, too. And he had collected what letters of hers survive, he actually collected in the 1930s. But what's happened since Van Doren tried to piece together Jane's life is, you know, a revolution in the writing of women's history. So we don't know that much about Jane, but we know a lot about ordinary women in their daily lives.
Well, you've written that she was everywhere, threaded through his life, Benjamin's life, like a slip stitch. So do we know why Ben didn't mention Jane in his autobiography, which was published around the time of his death?
Yeah, I think we do, in the sense that Franklin was a myth maker. He was very self-consciously writing the story of his life as the story of America. You know, sort of, you rebel against tyranny and you become independent. And you do that yourself, and you are the author of your own life. And this notion of independence required the kind of rendering of invisible of relationships of dependence around him. There's a lot of people Franklin didn't write about in his autobiography who helped him out. That story of the self-made man requires pretending that there's no one else helping you out.
Well, you have to only guess at what she thought. I don't know if she read the book, but people today would look for their name in the index, and it's not there. So I don't want to read this book. But you've said that none of Benjamin Franklin's writing can be understood without understanding his sister Jane.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's her life was not significant in the sense that she wasn't the one who wrote these, you know, the Silence Do Good essays. She didn't create Poor Richard's Almanac. She didn't sign the Declaration of Independence. But you can see her as a reader of all of those things. Franklin sent her books all the time. They exchanged ideas all the time. They wrote really quite avidly to one another. And I think that a lot of Franklin's political philosophy and his emerging ideas about inequality and political inequality have to do with how he thought about the family he left behind, the family of poverty that he was born into and from which he escaped.
Well, he was the youngest of 10 boys, and she was the youngest of 7 girls. That's a lot of kids. And they were called Benny and Jenny in the family. Were they drawn together because they were the youngest, or was there something else that tied them together?
I think they were both really saucy, and they were both very miffy. And these are words they both used to describe themselves. You know, Franklin's a very cheeky, funny person, and actually so was Jane. And any biographer who's really looked carefully at the Franklins notices that of all the people in the family, they're the two who are the most alike in that sense.
And I get the feeling from what you've written that Benjamin and Jane may have been born with similar intellectual gifts, but that their futures were determined largely by their sexes. At that time, weren't only boys sent to school? Girls taught what they needed to know at home.
Yeah, so, you know, you can't really know. Like, I think we should care about Jane Franklin whether or not she was a genius, right? Like, the story of her life is about being ordinary, not about this sort of hidden Milton somewhere. But we forget, and I think also, especially in the kind of the age of the Tea Party, it's really easy to forget and important to remember the vast inequalities of 18th century life. So boys were taught to read and write. That was mandated as public school education in Boston in the 18th century. Girls were taught to read and not to write.
And many couldn't even sign their own names.
Yeah, and you would learn to sign your own name sometimes just as an act of mechanics, but that's not a kind of writing.
Although we do have you give us some examples of her writing in this book, and she's looks pretty competent.
Yeah.
Just decent handwriting.
Yeah, she does, and I think partly because her brother taught her how to write. I mean, I think for Franklin, who thought a lot about female education as a boy because it was a lively debated topic in Boston in the 17 teens and 20s, I think she was a bit of an experiment to him.
Weren't many fathers worried that daughters who spent too much time reading wouldn't develop the skills they needed to be good wives?
Yeah, or that, you know, in the same way that it's illegal to teach a slave to learn to write, right? So because a slave could write a pass and escape and pass off as free, forge a pass, women, you know, were supposed to be submissive in every way. If you read, to read the Bible so that you could learn to be a good, submissive Christian, that was an important kind of learning. But writing was a kind of defiance, would open up opportunities for rebellion.
Ben ran away when he was 17. She was 11. And then they started corresponding almost immediately?
Yeah. Well, the first letter he writes home, or the first letter that he writes home that survives, is he writes home on the day he's 21. So he was apprenticed and was supposed to be apprenticed until the day he turned 21, when you came of age, when he ran away. And so the day he did turn 21, he was living in Philadelphia, it was a big day for him. And the thing he did that day was to write home to his little sister, Jane.
My guest is Jill Lepore, whose latest book is called Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Throughout her life, Jane was self-conscious about her writing skills, and she sometimes apologized in her letters for her shortcomings. Didn't Benjamin try to reassure her? He told her she wrote better than most American women did.
Yeah, this is one of those things, you know, if you teach 18th century prose, it drives students batty to read 18th century women's writings because they're loaded. Oh, please excuse me, for I know not how to write, and I do not deserve to hold the pen in my delicate fair hand. You know, it just drives you nuts. Just the incredible deference. It's formulaic. It's just necessary culturally to do that. And Jane did it all the time with Benjamin, not with anybody else, because she was incredibly proud of her ability to write. It was quite unusual. And so, you know, he would just make fun of her when she apologized. Like, you know, I think you're just fishing for commendation.
Well, she wasn't necessarily the best speller, but I was wondering whether that was because Noah Webster hadn't yet published his dictionary and spelling was a kind of a personal thing.
Spelling was a personal thing, but spelling in the way that printers used to develop a standard of spelling marked you as a learned or a lettered man. Women were generally less lettered in that sense. So it did. It was actually like a visual marker of your degree of education in a way that's a little bit difficult for us to see now. It doesn't mean that she was profoundly ignorant, because lots of learned people spelled quirkily too. But it certainly meant she didn't have Franklin's fluency with prose.
And when she was just 15 years old, she married Edward Meekham, a saddle maker, who was 7 years older than she was. Although there's no record of a baby being born soon after the wedding, you speculate that Jane may have been pregnant at the time. What led you to consider that possibility?
Well, I don't know. It's frustrating as a historian to have so many little dark corners of the room. You can't find a candle when you need one. The average age of marriage was 24 at the time. It was also illegal to marry at 15. You had to have parents' special approval if you were under 16. Franklin married at 24. All of their siblings married at like 22, 23, 24. It was a really weird age to get married.
And then Edward Meekham wasn't necessarily the kind of guy that you'd want your daughter to marry.
No. He lived next door. It turned out he was a drunk, and it turned out that he also had a kind of congenital mental illness that led him to die prematurely, and all of Jane's sons inherited this insanity. So I don't think her parents were really eager to sign her up for the nuptials.
They lived in poverty until he died, but he gave her 12 kids. You say Jane never wrote about her husband with affection, but she was said to have admired his singing voice.
Well, I don't know, stretching there. You don't want to think of someone as, you don't want to draw the conclusion that someone's life is more miserable than it already, in a kind of evidentiary way, is.
Well, still, it's kind of stunning that she had 13 kids by the time she was 39 years old. Three of them died in infancy, and although the rest survived childhood, two of them suffered from mental illness. Several others died in their 20s of what's now thought to have been tuberculosis, I think. At that time, didn't one quarter of children die before they were 10 years old?
Yeah, and for me, working on this life of Jane, who so carefully chronicled the births and deaths of her children, my book is called Book of Ages, after this little scrapbook that Jane keeps, in which she records the births and then almost inevitably the deaths of her 12 children. To try to really wrestle, like, we know that, okay, so one in four children, it's just such a cold, hard statistic. It's so inconceivable to us to think about that. And I think people often assume, oh, children died all the time, people must be sort of used to it. Well, like, no, there's just no way in human history that you expect or can easily endure the suffering and loss of a child. And just telling Jane's story was a way to really think carefully about what those losses meant.
It also gives us a sense of what women's lives were like in the early days of the United States. Earlier in the day, I spoke to Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote about a woman who was born in 1800 and who could establish herself as a woman of science because the world was changing. Also, she came from a more well-to-do family and had all sorts of opportunities that Jane didn't have. But could Ben have helped her to escape this situation?
Well,
I mean, he was pretty famous during much of his lifetime.
He certainly was, yeah.
I mean, he had some money.
Yeah, he did. Although, you know, Franklin wasn't a big seeker of riches. That's actually a weird kind of late 19th century capitalist myth. He was incredibly generous towards Jane. When their father died and left him a special inheritance, he gave it to her. He later in her life purchased the mortgage on a house and gave it to her. He sent her firewood every winter so that she wouldn't freeze to death. I mean, he sort of undertook small acts of charity. What he mostly tried to do was help out, in particular, one of her sons.
Do we know what she read?
We do. I spent a lot of time reconstructing her library, which is an incredibly fun thing to do because she's really an avid reader. She write desperately, please send me books, you know, please, please. She lived her whole life in Boston, and Franklin would send her books from all over the world.
Books about that were related to the Enlightenment, or did she read fiction?
You know,
would she read Jane Austen?
Yeah, no. So she wouldn't have. She would have missed Jane Austen. She died in 1793. But she did read some fiction. Like, I think she read Pamela, but she excellently loved politics. She wanted political philosophy. That's the thing that she really got off on. And she got really absorbed in those ideas, the basic questions about the relationship between a man and his rulers. That's what she wanted to know. Why is society ordered in the way that it is ordered? She had the questions that all other great 18th century thinkers had.
And obviously got her older brother thinking about some of those things as well.
I think he was answerable to her view.
Her book, Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin, is published by Knopf. And Jill, it's been a great pleasure having you on our show today.
Thanks, as always.
It's always wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow at noon, as part of WNYC's special programming, I'll present my annual Christmas special of great gospel classics, and we'll hear songs of the season from singers like Mahalia Jackson, Edna Goldman Cook, Marion Williams, Lou Rawls, the Swan Silvertones, and many others. And you can find the playlist for tomorrow's special now on our show page, along with our staff's list of their favorite segments of the year and also their favorite books. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshik, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Dartu is at the audio controls. And we had help today from Gabrielle Alfiero, Hugh Sansom, and Nellie Gillis. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We all wish you a very Merry Christmas. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow for some great gospel music.